No, no, it's just a kid growing up on the wrong side of railroad tracks. After a while, you get a little bit of pride in you. It's real hard to get that pride back out of you.
Tell me about how when you'd walk around town and you'd run into previous employees.
It was really heartbreaking because I love my employees, and they love me, and I mean that honestly and openly and in a very manly way. You know, it was that kind of relationship. We truly respected each other. We may have had different pay grades, and we may have had different duties, may have had different titles, and may have even driven different cars and lived in different sides of the street or different sides of town, but we loved each other and respected each other for who and what we were while we were at work. And I just had that bond with my employees that I respected them for what they did for me, for what they brought, for what they contributed, and I made sure they knew that. I made sure they didn't have to guess it. I made sure that they knew it every single day, every single way, that I respected and appreciated them. And it doesn't mean I was going to suck up. It doesn't mean I was going to let them get away with murder. It doesn't mean I was going to make their job terribly easy. It just meant I was going to respect them. Well, when you respect people, that resonates with people. They get that. They really, really get it. And the bond they will then have to, with, and for you is supreme. And so I would meet former employees, people who had lost their job at my company, who would hug me on the street. And there would be times when, you know, it sounds really silly, and I now can whip just about any man I've ever met, would cry, would hug each other and cry. Because we both missed what was missing, but, you know, we really still loved and respected each other.
Who is Jay Jones?
Jay Jones was a fellow I met during the pipe company days. He had another business across town that was being liquidated, and he showed up at my doorstep one day and needed a place to wind down his business, and we had been introduced informally by a third party. And I gave him a spare office, gave him a spare telephone, and you know, I admired him for wanting to liquidate his business in a forthright manner instead of just filing bankruptcy and skipping out of town. And so he came to me literally 20 years ago and just stayed, and he just proved his value, proved his worth, and started contributing, and pretty soon he ended up on payroll, and pretty soon he ended up a significant part of my company.
For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com. What was the transition between the pipe company and the beginnings of you looking for new opportunities?
The transition, you know, really didn't take the full 3 years that it took me to go all the way up to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, because you can't wait without working during a three-year period. You got to go find something to do to pay the rent. And since Jay Jones had been my associate, not a business partner, not an economic interest holder of the pipe company, but a very good and loyal employee, and he stayed with me during the downtimes. Remember, we just talked a minute ago about how your friends have vanish like smoke on a windy day. Well, Jay Jones didn't vanish. Jay Jones stood right there alongside of me. And maybe because he was the only one that made him even more special for me. And so he became my best friend. He became my compadre, so to speak. And so he and I were both broke. We were both out of a job. Neither one of us had any money. Didn't have a pot or a window. But we really kind of felt that we wanted to go do something together. So we explored hundreds of ideas. Literally hundreds of ideas of how can we go make a living? What can we do? What skills and attributes do we have that translate into a need in the marketplace, and everything from getting a string of hot dog vendor carts. I mean, we actually debated that once, and thank God we voted no on it, but that was one of the ideas.
Now, were you getting harassed by creditors?
Oh, indeed, because we had gone broke, and although I had now successfully proven I should not be bankrupt, the net result of that was I wasn't in bankruptcy. It didn't mean I didn't know anybody. It just meant I wasn't officially bankrupt, which means I get to go all the way to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals to prove I should not be in bankruptcy, and the award or the prize for winning that contest is I get to be $1 million in debt. You say, wait a minute, I thought you were a smart guy. Why didn't you just roll over and make that $1 million and go away? Well, that's not the way I operate. That's not the way I think. And so I was $1 million in the hole, and because I refused to file bankruptcy and owed people some money that I couldn't afford to pay, I was getting collection calls all hours of the night from, and it would be an exaggeration to say every collection agency in America, because it wasn't quite that many, but there were days that seemed like it. So Kathy and I learned a lot about the debt collection industry. Mostly we learned what not to do.
How did the creditors treat you?
Oh, it was so bad, Michael. They would yell and scream and threaten and harass and harangue and use profanity. And even as our young daughters answer the telephone, they would say things like, tell your deadbeat dad if he doesn't pay up, we're coming there, we know where he lives, and things like that. You know, that macho, bravo, baloney crap. We would just shake our heads and say, don't they get it? Even if we had money, we wouldn't pay them now. You know, they're making us mad. We would carry the logical conversation to the next point and say, why doesn't somebody do this right? Why doesn't somebody do this with dignity and respect? You don't have to be Pollyanna. You don't have to roll over and forget they owe you money. You can collect from them. Why can't you collect from people using dignity and respect? Kind of like the way I talk about my employees. You don't have to let them come in late. You don't have to let them leave early. You don't have to let them wear their hair long or wear stupid clothes to work. You have the right to enforce all the rules. But why can't you do that with dignity and respect? And we asked that question out loud, and essentially the light bulb went on.
What was the nature of the collection industry in the United States at that time? Was it small shops? Was there any kind of systemization to it? Anything good about it? Any success?
There were marginal successes, very few. There were 6,000 collection agencies in America in 1986 when we started our company. Most of them were mom and pop. Most of them were local operations collecting bills for the local dentist or the dry cleaner or the grocery store or the gas station, which in fact in those days would give personal credit. And they were all essentially small mom-and-pop kind of operations. There were a couple, two publicly held companies, but they weren't very big and they weren't doing very well and they weren't being run very well either. So mostly the collection industry was kind of, I don't want to say Stone Age, but it was really very backward.
Tell me about when you and Jay saw that ad in the newspaper. What did it say?
A bank phenomenon occurred in the mid-80s, and it was when the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation started shutting down banks that were becoming insolvent, which is part of what happened when the oil boom went bust. Banks went right behind it. And the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, was in charge of liquidating all these quote-unquote failed banks. Well, when the bank failure rate first started, the FDIC had enough employees to take all the bad loans into its own house and sell off the good loans to a new acquiring bank, because the new acquiring bank didn't want the bad loans, they just wanted the good ones. But after a while, there were so many bank failure rates, the FDIC could no longer take into inventory the bad loans because they were bursting at the seams. And so with that, for the very first time in the history of the United States, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1986, the FDIC decided to advertise in the newspaper to sell some bad loans. So it's right at the beginning of an industry. I mean, it's that Big Bang theory. It's when you can still hear the noise going on. The FDIC put an ad in the newspaper, and it was a typical government ad. I mean, they're the same people who pay $600 for a toilet seat, so you don't come to expect very much out of them.
Was it in the classified section?
No, it was in the business section. It was a little block ad, probably a 3x3, and it said, bad loans for sale. Contact FDIC.
And they wanted to sell it off to, like, the smaller collection agencies to raise cash? What was their purpose of selling
them? They wanted to sell them to liquidate them to raise cash. I don't care who bought them. They just wanted to sell them.
Right, so you saw the ad. The first time you saw it, you didn't think much of it, and you threw it out.
Oh, Michael, the first time I saw it, you know, bad loans for sale? I mean, you have to be real smart. I mean, that's like a classic oxymoron. Why would anybody in their right mind spend good money to buy bad loans? I mean, it just was one of those non-starters. I laughed at it. I thought, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my whole life. Why would anybody spend good money to buy bad loans? It just didn't make sense. And I threw the newspaper away with a laugh. Next day, thank God, they ran the same ad again, and I saw it the second day, and I thought, no, it's still stupid, but I didn't quite think it was as stupid as I did the first day, and threw the paper away anyhow. Third day, saw the ad again. Now I've got 3 days to think about it. And the light bulb went on. I said, you know, if you could buy them cheap enough, maybe there'd be an economic deal here, because maybe these people who are, quote-unquote, the bad loans, the ones who aren't paying, maybe they're just like me and Kathy. Maybe they're honorable people. I mean, honorable, the whole way up to fighting to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals to be not in bankruptcy, but still couldn't pay my bills. Say, well, maybe they're like us, and maybe they just need somebody to work with them. So now it became economic. It's thinking, okay, well, they're not worth 100 cents on the dollar, that's for sure, but are they worth 1 cent on the dollar? Because the lower you get to the bottom, the more value you can create in it. And so we negotiated a transaction with the FDIC that we bought a box of loans for essentially 3 cents on the dollar.
And your plan was to call and try and collect this money yourself personally?
Yeah, absolutely. I went back to the bank that I owed $1 million to and borrowed $13,000. That's what it cost me for this very small package of loans. And we drove to Tulsa, Oklahoma, picked up the box of loans, drove them back to Muskogee, Oklahoma, set them on the kitchen table, and literally started pulling the file folders out one at a time with me on the telephone calling each of the individual customers up, trying to persuade them into paying.
How did you get that bank to loan you $13,000 when you owed $1 million? And did you really think they were going to lend that to you?
Yeah. See, it's reverse psychology. They had 1 million reasons to lend it to me. only when you think about it from the reverse. See, everybody else would walk in saying, oh my God, I owe $1 million, they won't like me, they'll be mad at me, they're going to think I'm a failure, they're going to think I screwed up, they're the last people in the world I should ever try and borrow money from, I should change my name and go to the bank down the street. That's what most people think. I saw it the other way around and said, I owe them $1 million. They know I owe them $1 million. And if I never get another job, if I never get another business, if I never get ahead, I can never pay them. They need to help me get ahead. So I went back to them with that pitch, saying, hey, I want to pay you, but I can't afford to pay you. And unless I get a business going, I'm never going to be able to pay you. Here's an idea that I think could work, and it's going to cost you a little bit of money to gamble on me. And if you think I'm worth the gamble, $13,000, then go ahead and put the money in the pot, and we'll gamble. If you don't think it is, fine. Thank you very much. I now have tried to repay your $1 million. You told me no. Well, they said yes.
For more free reports, products, and services from Bill Bartman, go to www.billionairebubba.com. That's www.billionairebubba.com. Okay, that's great. So you brought this box of oil into them. Was it literally paper?
Yeah, this is back in 1986 and everything was still on paper. The computer industry was still in its infancy, and so there was no electronic files. At least if there weren't electronic files in the banking industry. So we literally had a box of paper.
What kind of loans were they? They weren't credit card debt.
No, they were consumer loans. They were people who had purchased automobiles or boats or recreational vehicles or things of that sort, things you'd use in a consumer environment. But they had also gone into default, and so the personal property that was a collateral for the note had now been repossessed, which meant that all we were really buying were the deficiency balances.
Was this the worst of the worst kind of paper you could buy?
Yeah, it wasn't ugly. It was mud ugly. It was double ugly, as they would call it.
Did you know what the collection industry out there typically could earn back on that debt?
I knew what the competitors were doing, and the competitors were getting 5 to 6 cents on the dollar out of this kind of paper, and we were going to pay 3 on it. And I was pretty sure I could do a lot better than the average guy because I just thought I was going to do different than the average guy. Number one, I had a dynamic going for me that they didn't. The standard of the industry was if you were a debt collection company, you really didn't own the debt. You were just servicing the debt for somebody else. It was only in your custody for maybe 90 to 120 days. So if you were to effectuate any recoveries, you had to do it within a very brief time window. Well, if I owned the debt, I could spend a year collecting from you.
I see. So because this was the very first time the FDIC sold the actual paper.
Right.
So before that happened, they would just lease the paper to a collection agency for a period?
Yes.
And it was 90 days about the maximum?
Yes.
So they were rushed to use pressure tactics?
Absolutely.
And that's probably where it all came from?
Yeah, the old chicken-egg theory, yeah. It's a bad people or a bad idea, and sometimes you can't tell the difference.
All right, so you had an advantage. You had all the time in the world. How old was the paper?
Most of it was a year and a half to 2 years delinquent.
Okay, so you've got this paper in your kitchen, and you've got your phone. Do you remember your very first call?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those things, kind of like remembering where I was when Kathy finally saw the value in me.
Tell me about it. Can you bring me back?
Yeah, I know the guy's name. I won't say it over the radio, but he lived in Garden City, Kansas. And I remember calling him up, and the way the script went, I mean, it wasn't much of a script at all. It was, Mr. Blank, my name is Bill Bartman. I purchased a loan from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation from the Sale Bank of Tulsa. And it shows here, according to our records, that you owe $4,378. Now, Mr. Smith, what can we do about that? And that's when I would shut up. My script was now over. And there'd be a very, very long pause and a very quiet moment. And then eventually he would say something. And he would most likely, you know, most people, I mean, generically, say, gee, I don't have the money, I can't afford to pay, or my wife left me, or my dog died, or I lost my job, or my baby broke his leg. Or, you know, they come up with whatever story they would come up with. And I don't say story in the sense of fabrication. Story can be real, can be what's really going on in their life. And no matter what it is they would say, I would say, oh, man. That's too bad. That's really a shame that that happened in your life. Mr. Smith, tell you what, your life is really kind of chaotic right now. Why don't you take the next 3 months and try and get your life back together and just forget about me. Forget about me for the next 3 months and just go take care of your other obligations, and I'm going to leave you alone for the next 90 days. I'm not going to call you back. But on the 90th day, Mr. Smith, I am going to call you back, and I'd like to be able to work something out with you then. Would that be okay? Well, any fool in his right mind would say yes to that question.
And they all said yes.
They all said yes. And I'd say, great, thank you. Then I'm going to call you back in 90 days, Mr. Smith, and I'm going to remind you that you said it'd be okay. Now, is that okay that I remind you? And of course, I'd say yes again. Well, guess what? 90 days to the day, I'd call him and say, Mr. Smith, hi, it's Bill Bartman. Remember when you said I could call you 90 days from now? Is this a good time for us to talk? And mostly it would be, and so on occasion they'd say, no, can you call me later, can you call me tomorrow, can you call me next week, and I'd honor that. But once I got them on the phone, now next or later, I'd say, you know, we've got to do something about this obligation, so you tell me what it is you can do. I'm not going to tell you what I want. You tell me what it is you can do, and if you can make it make sense for me, I'll say yes to it. Well, that's the first time anybody on that end of the phone ever had the right and the power to negotiate, and that's a pretty good power. And they took advantage of it, and they would offer to pay 10, 20, 30, 40 cents on the dollar.
To pay it all off.
To wipe out the whole liability.
Did a lot of people want to just wipe it all out?
Oh, yeah. It's a negative blemish on their credit rating.
You didn't want to put them on payments.
Well, we did if that was the only alternative. We'd prefer to have even 30 cents on the dollar right now as 50, 60, 70 cents on payment terms.
So the real leverage in people paying this off, of course, is to not have that negative on their credit report.
That's the pragmatic one. But psychologically, and this is going to sound like Pollyanna, and forgive me, Michael, people really want to do the right thing. They really do. I mean, people are good. They really are. Now, we can find anecdotal exceptions to the contrary. There are some people who will knock your wheels off every day of the week. They'll hold your head down till your nose bleeds. There are people who wake up in the morning trying to figure out ways to take advantage of you. But mostly, and I don't know what the percentage is, I like to think it's 90-10, 90% of the people in the world are really decent, honorable people if you give them a chance to be decent and honorable. Most people don't believe that. I do.
That $13,000 investment, what did you turn it into?
Turned into a $63,000 recovery, which the deal I'd made at the bank to help them recover the $1 million was that I get the first $20,000 for my operating expenses. They get the $13,000 to retire the initial loan to buy the box of loans. And then anything else above and beyond that goes to retire my debt. So if they got 13, I got 20, that's 33, and there was 63. They got another $30,000 applied onto a $1 million debt.
Now, did you know you were sitting on a gold mine?
Not yet. And so as soon as I tendered that payment, I asked to borrow $100,000. And I went back and did it again. And by the time I'd done my second or my third one, I knew it wasn't a business. I knew it was an industry that had not yet been developed, that had not yet been started, that did not yet exist in nature. But, you know, I was riding the head of a comet, that I was going someplace where nobody had gone before. And I don't mean that in a kind of a egotistical way, because it wasn't me doing it. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time, recognizing an opportunity.
On the second $100,000 of debt that you got, were you still one-man operation?
Probably had hired one other person by then.
Were you refining your collection methods during that time?
Absolutely. We refined them, and I don't want to say every single day. That would be an exaggeration. We were perpetually refining the program.
Let's say there's a small business person out there listening to this, and they've got people who owe them money. Give them one or two techniques that you learned, especially in the early days. They're going to increase your chances on getting that money.
Respect. Call them up and treat them with dignity and respect. I mean, so if you're in the manufacturing business and one of your suppliers owes you money, the normal thing is you'll have your secretary, receptionist, or somebody from accounts receivable calling them up, and they're probably saying it with a nasally tone of, you're late, where's the payment? When are you going to be able to pay us? It's demanding. It's sinister. It's negative. You know, you're sending all the wrong signals. You have every right to say that. The person really does owe you the money. But is it about the right, or is it about the outcome? And if you'd rather have more outcome than right, then why don't you, as the principal of the company, call that person up yourself and say, hey, Joe, you know, I know times are tough right now, and, you know, I see my accounts payable people just sent me a memo that you're 90 days late on your account, and I know you well enough to know that there must be some really bad things going on. Is there something I can do to help?
Were you using any direct mail at that time?
No.
Was the industry using it?
The collection industry was, and I thought it was a waste of time and a waste of energy.
So you chose against direct mail?
Yeah, we didn't use a drop of it ever.
You guys were averaging about 48% net profit on what you guys were collecting, which was unheard of in the industry. So I wanted to talk about what made CFS so good at collections.
There were actually several dynamics that caused that giant margin to occur. That margin is almost an anomaly in any industry. But a couple of things, and we'll talk about them in order. There is, firstly, this concept of the first mover, and the first mover in a particular industry is the one who gets out there first, comes up with a brand new or different way of doing the old thing. And to that person, you know, as I say, to the pioneer go the spoils. He who gets there first gets the most. And we got there before there was any competition. So the law of supply and demand was way out of balance. There was not much competition for the industry because, quite frankly, we were first. We were the only people in the playground, so to speak. And so the margins were gargantuan in the early days. Now, in reality, the margins did shrink in later years when new competition came into the industry and created some pricing competition where we had to begin to pay a bit more for our inventory than we were paying even in the early days.
Now, was this from the FDIC? You were paying around 3 cents on the dollar. How high did it go?
This is where you have to be really careful so you don't sound like you're saying something stupid. There was different grades or quality of paper product. Some of the loans were very, very old and very hard to collect, and some of them were more recent and more fresh and therefore easier to collect. And so the pricing would modulate severely between one and the other. By way of example, really old debt would be worth a penny or two or three. That'd be debt that was maybe 4, 5, 6 years old, and nobody had made a payment during that period of time. Debt that was only 90 days old could be worth 45, 50, 60 cents to purchase it, because you'd still be making the reciprocal, assuming you could collect it.
When you first started, the very first debt you bought, what quality paper was that?
It was the mud ugly. It was the junk on the bottom of the barrel. It was the worst of the worst. It was the ugly of the ugly. I mean, I can't think of any more ways of describing it pejoratively, and for a good reason. It was the very first loan inventory ever being sold by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and like all governmental agencies, they are bureaucrats to the core, and so their way of beginning a sales vehicle was to sell that which there could be no penalty for making a bad decision. In other words, sell something that was essentially worthless.
Did they eventually have better paper, the FDIC?
Indeed they did. And with the FDIC, over the course of the years, we began buying better paper. And towards the end of the ride with them, which would have been late 80s, early 90s, we were paying as much as 30, 35 cents on the dollar. But again, these were loans that were clearly more collectible and less aged than the material we'd bought previously for pennies on the dollar.
Well, as the new paper, the better quality paper, became available, did you shy away from the but ugly paper, or were the margins comparable because you could get it at such a reduced price?
The margins remain comparable, and so we continue to invest in the tertiary paper, as they called it. There'd be primary paper, secondary paper, and tertiary paper. Primary paper meaning it had only been to one collection agency since it went bad. Secondary paper means it had gone to two different collection agencies in succession since it went bad. And tertiary means it actually went to three different collection agencies in succession since it went bad. So what that really means for tertiary paper is four people, the primary issuer, beat on it for a while, gave it to a primary collector, they beat on it for a while, assuming they didn't collect it, went to a secondary collector, they beat on it for a while, and then it went to a tertiary or a third collector, and they beat on it for a while, so it really got beat on by four people before we bought it. So no wonder it was so cheap.
How systematized did your company become? You talked about a summit where you got a bunch of people together and you came up with this 200-page systems manual and also your CFS University. Can you talk about the systemization of a company and how important that is for profitability and success?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Michael. And it is crucial. And again, because we recognized we were the first mover, we recognized we were getting in early, we recognized we were going to get the fruits of the spoils if we got there first, if we were correct in our assumptions that this was even a prudent investment to make. We also knew intelligently that we couldn't hold on to that margin by being the first mover forever. We knew the law of supply and demand would find balance, and it always, always does. And so we knew that while we were reaping these giant windfalls up front because of the first mover position, we needed to take that money and reinvest it into the company and create systems that would then make us so efficient that even when the pricing margins began to narrow, when the competition started raising the price, then we too would have to pay more for the product, that we would be able to collect it more efficiently than would our competitor. So if our competitor and we both paid the same price for the product, but we could collect it at 2x, and they could only collect it at 1x, or it only cost us 0.5x, and it cost them 1x. Either one of those variables worked. We had both variables. The systems we created allowed us to collect more than our competitor, so we were getting 2x, so they're 1x, and our systems allowed us to do it more efficiently, so we were only expending 0.5x against their 1x to produce the result we respectively were producing. So net, at the end of the day, because of our systems, we were running at 1.5x to our competitors. Well, that's a wonderful place to find yourself.
What did it cost to put these systems in place in dollar terms?
Yeah, they cost a lot. They cost a lot of human capital. They cost a lot of intellectual capital. And over the course of the 13 years of our company, they did cost a lot of economic capital as well. But probably the first greatest expenditure was in our human capital and our intellectual capital. It was having the discipline, and I don't think it's anything more than that, just the discipline when we recognized that which I just described, that we were not going to be able to retain first mover position for very long, or as long as we wanted, that we needed to have a replacement and a substitute for that we actually sat down and said, okay, we have to create systems that will take us there. And when you sit down to create systems, it isn't something like having a coffee party or a tea party or even a pizza and beer party that you're going to be able to sit down, write a few notes, laugh and giggle, and everybody go home. No, this is where you literally have to dissect everything. I mean, it's a bit like doing a post-mortem. You're taking this cadaver apart. In this case, we're taking apart our company. We're looking at every single system within our company, how we answer the telephone, how we open the mail, how we file papers, how we collected loans, how we did our bookkeeping, accounting. There was nothing that we did, nothing. There was not one single function within our company that we didn't tear apart and analyze with the question of why are we doing it that way? Is there a better way to do it? Because most people, honestly, Michael, never ask that question. They just instead keep on doing what it is they're doing, assuming that, number one, there either is no other way, or the way they're doing is pretty good or good enough. We found out some remarkable, remarkable things, some of which were extremely counterintuitive, that we never would have discovered but for this rigorous discipline that we put ourselves through. And so, as you mentioned, we ended up creating a 200-page document that codified our systems within the organization. Now, over the course of time, that document actually grew larger.
Okay, great. How soon did you realize that the FDIC paper was running out, and what did you do as far as a company looking for new bad debt to acquire? Where were you looking to for new bad debt?
We saw the FDIC coming to an end because we had our feelers out. We had our radar out. We were always anticipating what can go wrong. We are very, very strong proponents in the concept of strategic planning. And part of a strategic planning process is, you know, literally anticipating what might go wrong, what bad thing might occur, and what would be your contingency plan in the event that were to occur. So even during the height of our glory with the FDIC, while the money was rolling in and the inventory was ever present and life was great, we were already asking the questions of how will it begin to look if this inventory ever starts subsiding? How will it begin to look if we ever have to worry about the FDIC going away? Because we knew if the FDIC went away, if they quit selling us a product, they were our sole source of inventory. That if they ever went away and quit doing business with us, that'd be calamitous. So we had to assume it could only happen one of two ways. One, either we did something really, really stupid, bad, wrong, that they would then choose to not do business with us, or two, the climate would change politically or economically to cause them to not have inventory available for resale. So having this early warning radar system, and that's really what did the magic. It isn't that we're so smart. We had an early warning radar system, and the early warning radar system started picking up changes within the FDIC in terms of the volume and the regularity at which they were offering material. We had monitors to measure how many bank failures were occurring over a season, over a geographic area, and we began to detect that the rate was slowing down. Almost imperceptible to the public eye, we could see some sea changes. We could see there were some bellwether signs here that inventory was going to decrease, but it probably wouldn't decrease appreciably for the next 12 months. Then thereafter, it would start depreciating just incredibly fast. Well, seeing that and seeing it 12 months before anybody else saw it coming, it allowed us to position ourselves differently. So we then went to a secondary source. We went to this other federal agency called the Resolution Trust Corporation. Because if you could imagine the FDIC on a bell-shaped curve, they're coming up towards the top, towards the crest of the bell, and they were still at their zenith. But if you look over the top of a bell, you'll see that it was a roller coaster ride down. Well, the RTC was just beginning as an agency, and so they were at the bottom of that upslope. And so we thought, aha, this would be a great time for us to shift some of our resources away from FDIC, which is the mature business, and begin to refocus them over on the RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation, because they are just beginning to ride up. And lo and behold, the RTC is kind of a mirrored image of what we found originally with the FDIC, ergo limited or no competition.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. In a nutshell, who were they? What did they do? RTC.
The Resolution Trust Corporation was set up by the federal government to dispose of the assets from failed savings and loans. So they were different from the FDIC only in the type of loans they dealt with. The FDIC dealing with banks and bank loans were mostly consumer and commercial loans. The RTC dealing mostly with savings and loans were predominantly real estate loans, sometimes very large commercial real estate loans as well as single family.
Okay, so then you started buying their paper.
Correct.
How did the price compare to the FDIC?
It was a stepped-up price compared to what we found on day one of the FDIC because the market, although it wasn't as vigorous on the RTC side, at least the concept had already been proven. So competition started moving in more quickly than it did the first time at FDIC. And so the pricing started at the 20, 25, 30-cent level.
I see. So this was eating into margins as competitors came in.
Yes, and we literally then had to face not mom and pop, people like ourselves in the early days, you know, literally a kitchen table beginning, but now the new guy in the street might be Morgan Stanley or Bear Stearns or Payne Weber.
All right, let's talk about maybe these declining margins created a need for more money and how you created this novel financial instrument called securitization. Can you explain that and how did that become?
Actually, that's a third morphing because as the RTC got to the top of its bell-shaped curve, again, the warning signs went off. Actually, before it got to the top of the bell-shaped curve, the warning signs went off. And by then, the RTC was already down the backside of their slope, and they were going into oblivion. But now we're sitting on essentially the top of the RTC curve, and we knew what came next for them. And so now we had to make a third transition. We went from collecting FDIC loans to collecting RTC loans, and now we're having to make our third life transition as a company. And we said, we need to be somewhere else. There is no longer an FDIC to buy from. They're pretty much gone. And RTC is going to be running out quickly. Where do we go next?
Credit card debt?
Yep. And so we looked out on the industry, and we said, okay, what kind of debt is out there? This is back in the early 90s, 91 probably. And credit card debt was just beginning to become an issue. But the problem we ran into, Michael, is no bank at that moment of time had ever sold their bad loans. They had never sold their charged off credit card loans. Remember, all the inventory we were buying previously came from federal agencies that had shut down a financial institution. So anyhow, we then had that desire and a need to be somewhere different. We saw some product, but we ran into this brick wall of, yeah, well, no bank has ever sold your credit card loans. What makes you think you can talk them into selling them? So that was our first challenge, and it was a great challenge, but we accepted it and said, well, what would it take to make them say yes? Nobody's ever asked. Nobody knows what it takes to make them say yes, so let's play banker. What would it take to make them say yes? And we went through a concept that later became known as outsourcing, you know, which, you know, I'm not that we're that clever, but we didn't even have a name on it when we thought of it. We thought, well, what if we could persuade a bank to sell us all of their bad loans as soon as the bad loans go bad? And we could do it at a price that's economical for the bank vis-a-vis what they used to be able to collect minus the cost of their own collection staff. And now the bank, if they were to say yes to this outlandish proposition that no one's ever done, then the bank wouldn't have to have all those collection employees on salary and on staff, which is the argument for outsourcing of anything.
How inefficient were the banks?
They were banks. By definition, they were inefficient. And I don't mean to say that in a negative way. I'll say it in an honest way. Banks make their money off good loans. Banks make their money with the premise that a certain percentile of the loans they make will, in fact, go bad. If they are not achieving that certain percentile of loss, then they know they're not being aggressive enough. In other words, they have a mindset that they expect a certain percentage of loans to go bad and will push until they get to that certain percentage. They then, as bankers, take that as a risk they assumed upon entry into the industry It's acceptable. It's normal. It's regular. It's exactly what your peers are suffering. And at that point, they literally don't care about those loans. And because of that mentality, they spend little or essentially no money trying to collect those loans efficiently.
So would they come off better collecting them efficiently compared to just writing it off as bad debt?
Well, yeah, they would have to write them off as bad debt. That's just an accounting process. That doesn't mean they don't continue to try to collect them. They have to write them off their books if under GAAP accounting at the end of their 90 or 120-day window where there have been no previous collections. But once they write them off, most financial institutions would then endeavor to collect them. But remember, collections are 3% of their 97% business. So they didn't put much energy, they didn't put much resource, they didn't put their highest paid, best qualified people in charge of that department. They usually put their lowest paid, least qualified people in charge of that department, and they didn't have much of a standard of expectation. Well, when you create a business with low expectations, you end up with low results. So they end up with low results.
So how'd you do it? How'd you get the first one to say yes?
The very first one was Nations Bank. So we didn't even start small. We started big. We went to Nations Bank, and we had done the economics, because now, by virtue of our background at the FDIC, I had been in over 800 failed banks. So I did know a lot about banks, and I understood how they were put together, how they worked, how they thought, how they did their business. And I was no expert. I never want to call myself an expert on anything. But I had now been in over 800 failed banks over the course of the last 5 years, and I'm a reasonably studious fellow. I'm not a very smart guy, but I do pay attention, and I paid a lot of attention to how banks work. So I learned a lot about how banks regulate and how they run their business, and so I appealed to that interest. So I went to Nations Bank, I went to Charlotte, North Carolina, where they're from, and sat down with the head of their collection department and explained to this individual the economics and said, here's the deal I will make you. I will buy your charged-off bad loans, and I will agree to buy them into the future, and I will buy them every month from now on, which means if you can take comfort in the fact that I have the capacity to do that, two good things happen. One, you get a guaranteed result and guaranteed return every single month, no longer variable by how good your collectors are. You won't have any peaks or valleys. You'll have a guaranteed constant number that you can plug into your bookkeeping and accounting, and that's a big deal to a bank. And then secondly, you'll be able to remove essentially all of your collection staff because you won't need them anymore because essentially I have outsourced all of that. Well, those were two really good things for this banker to hear. You know, they had predictability of collections vis-a-vis by sale, not by collection, and they were going to be able to save all this stuff called salaries, benefits, and perks, and not have the headache and the hassle of a large staff. Now, the only problem is I didn't have any money, which takes us back to the securitization thing. You say, okay, you now have made a promise to Nations Bank that you're going to buy all of their bad loans. You're going to buy them every month from now on, but you don't have any money.
How much would that have cost?
In those days, Michael, it was relatively small. It was probably $1 million a month commitment. By the time CFS hit its zenith, we were at $50 million a month.
All right, so you needed money. Tell me, how did this idea of securitization, how did you come up with this?
I didn't really come up with the idea. I just took an idea and changed it. I mean, I don't think I've ever created anything new in my life. I just take two things that exist in nature and twist them a little differently and kind of juxtapose them, and sometimes it looks like a Picasso painting or one of those bizarro world characters, but that's how you, at least in my case, that's how I made essentially all of my money. I just changed reality. So I looked out there and I saw there was a thing called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae, and they were securitizations. No, we didn't create the term securitization. We created a kind of securitization, a brand new kind of one. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae had been doing it for essentially 15 or 20 years, where they were taking large pools of loans, putting them into one package, so to speak, and then they would sell interest or rights to that package to thousands, if not millions, of people. And that way, no one person would take a big loss. Everybody would share in the results, reward, and quite frankly, the loss if there were to be one, but mostly the reward. Now, the only difference between what they were doing and what I had to go do is they were securitizing or pooling together performing real estate loans that were adequately capitalized and adequately secured. So if they were putting your house into this loan, your house loan, they wouldn't do it unless the appraisal for your house exceeded the obligation on the house. So essentially, these were no-risk assets going into this pool where, you know, Michael was paying every single month and he had a great payment history. And by the way, if Michael ever decides to quit paying, we know the appraisal will allow us to even at foreclosure to sell it for more than Michael owed on it.
They were secure. Yours was an oxymoron.
It was like a double oxymoron. My customers hadn't paid anybody in 1, 2, 3, 5 years. And there were credit cards. Ergo, there was no collateral whatsoever. The two things that Ginnie Mae and Freddie Mac had, we didn't have either one of them. We didn't have performing loans, and we didn't have the collateral.
What did the first bank say to you?
Oh, the first nine went through nine different investment bankers, and they told us we were stupid. They told us it was crazy. They told us it could not be done. It would not be done. It would never be done. And they gave us all of their good reasons why this is the stupidest thing they've ever heard in their entire life.
And then finally, Bank One?
It was Bank One Capital Corp out of Ohio. I don't know who they merged with, probably Chase by now, not J.P. Morgan. They actually went to them because they were aggressive. They were young and restless, as they would say, in the industry. And we had lots of data. And I'm a data hog. I'm an analyst by nature, I think. And I love data. And so I went to them with all the empirics and said, look, nobody's ever done this. It's never been done in history. But look at the data. The data tells us it can be done. Statistically, X number of people will pay over Y amount of time. And I have enough data points to establish that now. And I've got enough data coming in that eventually this is going to become actuarial, where it'll become so finitely predictable that you'll never be able to tell whether Joe is going to pay or Bob's going to pay or Tom's going to pay. But as a pool of people, you'll be able to know. I mean, just like gambling in Las Vegas. It's not a gamble for the casino owners. It's actuarial. Now, they don't know who's going to win or who's going to lose, and they don't even know how little or how much an individual will win or lose, but they can predict relatively finitely what their losses or wins are going to be over a certain window of time, just like insurance companies do with automobile insurance or life insurance. But nobody's ever gathered that kind of data for collections. Well, we were slowly gathering it. We weren't quite there yet in our early days. We got there by the end. But in the early days, we just had enough, number one, to prove we knew the concept, and two, to have enough data to support the concept. And so we went to Bank One Capital Corp and were able to persuade them to try to help us create the very first non-performing loan securitization. And 14 months later, we succeeded.
Okay, so they opened up the door for other banks to do the same, and then soon you had how many different banks offering you their bad credit card debt?
We ended up with, and I don't remember honestly the exact number, but I think it was 21 of the top 25. So we had 51% of the U.S. market. Now, back in those days, there were about 4,000 banks in America. It's the old 80-20 rule. 80% of the money is in 20% of the institutions. When we ended up with 21 of the top 25 banks in America under then long-term forward flow exclusive agreements where they were committed to sell to us and to us only a certain inventory of product for a very long period of time, it gave us a veritable market block that kept even Jack Welch and General Electric out.
And was the amount of credit card debt just staggering? Was it enough to feed you guys for many years?
Well, indeed. It continued to grow, and even today it is still a growing phenomenon. And where it'll end, God only knows, probably in calamity, because that's just the way things like that work. But it was growing so fast that it just worked in our favor, that the inventory kept increasing, and the banks were finding that even though it was only 3% of the total institution when it was a small piece of their business, now that credit cards are becoming a bigger piece of their business, is now 4%, 5%, 6%. And we actually saw during the mid-90s charge-off rates in America getting as high as 10%. Now, when that happens, that takes some of the giggle out of it for the bank.
Just for time references, we've got to speed ahead. I want you to tell me what happened on October 15th, 1998.
It's certainly a bad day in my life. October 15, 1998, one of the rating agencies, I believe it was Duff & Phelps, we had done business with all four rating agencies, contacted us to tell us that they had received an anonymous letter that had indicated that my former business partner, called by the name of Jay Jones, had committed a crime. Now, Mr. Jones had been my business partner for 20 years. He'd been my best friend for 20 years, and he'd been out of the business essentially for the last 2 years under a buyout buy-sell agreement that I'd executed with him 13 years earlier. But they were accusing him of having done some quote-unquote insider-like transactions. And I just knew that couldn't be so because this man is my best friend and a good man, in my humble opinion. So I said, I don't think that's true, but yeah, we'll go look into it. So we looked into it that afternoon, that evening, and the next morning, and sure enough, much to our disappointment and chagrin, we could see some evidence that Mr. Jones was in fact involved in doing something that later we were able to learn turned out to be quite criminal.
And what did you do? Did you remove yourself from the company?
I did indeed. I did several things, Michael, and I did them in rapid-fire succession trying to save started the company. This is my company. I owned 80% of it. We had built it up from the kitchen table, and I knew it was all built on trust. I mean, we were borrowing $50 million a month from Wall Street. I mean, it was staggering what we were doing. We had $1.6 billion worth of bonds outstanding. I mean, we were a privately held company, but clearly living in a very publicly financed arena, and trust is everything, and confidence. So I knew that if they, Wall Street, got nervous about what we were now seeing my partner having done, that that could be the death knell for our company. So I fired our accounting firm, I fired our law firm, and I fired our investment banker because I was afraid all three of them may have had some complicity with my former partner, because it would be real difficult for him to do what he's doing without somebody noticing, and everybody was acting like the three blind monkeys. You know, they just didn't see, didn't hear, didn't say anything. So I fired all three of them and replaced them all on day one. And then I hired James Woolsey. James Woolsey was the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he had been on our board, was actually on our board of directors at that time. And I asked him to take over the investigation, because my theory is quite obvious that you get somebody of that stature, somebody who's been approved by the Senate three times, he used to be the Secretary of the Navy. I mean, my God, this guy's above reproach. If I get him in charge of the investigation, that will quell any anxiety on Wall Street. Well, I then went to the next step, to make sure that they had nothing to worry about, that I would resign. I would resign for the next 30 days, allowing Mr. Woolsey to conduct the investigation, and during that interim, we would have an interim board, interim officers running the company in my stead, all with the supposition that we're going to find out that my business partner, my former business partner, had in fact committed a crime, but it was a relatively small and almost inconsequential or insignificant crime vis-a-vis the size and the depth and the breadth of our company. Well, that was a great theory, Michael, but it didn't work. When I resigned, it created the opposite reaction.
Made you look guilty?
Yeah. See, I did it thinking, I'm going to impress upon these guys, I'm going to convince them that I am so innocent and so righteous and so sure that we're going to come out squeaky clean, but for whatever little blip on the screen my partner had actually done, that they would have all this confidence. And I believe that. I really thought that. And I can't believe how wrong I was, because with my resignation, an entirely different reaction happened. And that reaction was, oh, look, he must be guilty. He's running for cover. Well, I didn't run anywhere. I stayed within the company. I went to a dollar a year salary, and I stayed on every single day to help and facilitate, but I removed myself from executive power so I couldn't be involved in any cover-up.
How many years later did they indict you?
4 years later, that was 1998. And in 2002, December of 2002, they indicted me. And it was after 2001, if you remember, when Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, Quest, and Adelphia occurred. And I had been a public figure. They couldn't not indict me. And so they did. They indicted me on 57 felony counts.
How many years would you be looking at?
Under then the federal guidelines for sentencing, it would have been over 600 years. Not enough, you know, your Bible, but that's more Noah, Moses, and Abraham. And nowhere in that book will you find a guy named Bill.
Before those 4 years, before the indictment, what were you doing during that period of time?
Well, the first year after CFS collapsed, I really can't say I did much of anything. I mean, I stayed home a lot. I dabbled in a few business deals. I owned a motorcycle, and I rode it frequently, because it was one of those periods of your life you go through that it's almost surreal. You wake up every morning wanting to pinch yourself that this really can't be happening, that this really can't have even occurred, that surely you're going to wake up tomorrow and it's going to be different. It'll be back to normal. I spent a whole year just kind of chilling out, as they would lovingly refer to it.
You get depressed?
Well, depression is a tough word, and I'm surely not ashamed of it or afraid of any word. I think I went through severe anxiety. I think I went through a lot of, you know, what happened, how did it happen? And I don't think it's ever reached anything near. I know it didn't reach clinical depression because I've never been medicated or anything like that. And again, I would certainly tell you if I had. It was never that, because I always knew I'd come out the other end. I always knew I was going to be okay. I always knew I was innocent. And that gives you a lot of comfort, a lot of strength at the end of the day.
Right. They froze all your assets, right?
Yes.
So you're basically broke. The government froze your assets during the indictment, correct?
That is absolutely correct. And when they freeze your assets, they literally take away your checking account, your savings account, your capacity to sell any of your real estate. They glommed onto my income tax refunds, the whole nine yards. So you literally are just locked down. And that's appropriate for people who are accused of a financial crime, because in essence, the finances that you're locking down almost always are a result of the company you work for. And so if indeed you were guilty of committing a financial-based crime, then that is the fruits of a crime.
Bring me up to the trial. How long did the trial last? How many witnesses? You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. For more interviews like this, go to HardToFindSeminars.com.
Well, let me give you a little preface to that. On the morning of trial, they offered me a misdemeanor. On the morning of trial, they said, Bill, you're charged with 57 felony counts, and that's 600 years in prison, but we will offer you a misdemeanor.
What was the misdemeanor?
They told me I could pick one. Then they said it in blunt terms. Well, you have to admit you did something, and if you admit you did anything, we'll let you go. You don't have to wear a bracelet, and like Martha, you don't have to go to jail, you won't be on probation, you won't have to pay a fine, but you got to admit you did something. And if you'll admit you did anything, we'll give you a misdemeanor count, and we'll make all 57 felonies on the trial go away.
You took it, right?
No.
What, are you crazy?
Yeah, I am crazy. My dad taught me a lot of things. My dad was a janitor. He had a third-grade education. He wasn't a very educated man. He certainly wasn't a very sophisticated man, but he taught me a lot. And one of the things he taught me as a youth, literally, was nobody can make you quit. You have to do that all by yourself. And those are pretty profound words, and they rang true inside my head that morning. So Kathy and I, my wife of 33 years, who has been with me through all the thick and all the thin of life, we sat down and had to make a really tough decision. Do we take this, frankly, very wonderful deal, but have to admit to something you really didn't do, and that'd be quitting? Or do you fight the federal government with no money in your pocket and no reputation and no integrity and no character left because they've taken all that away? And we really knew there was only one choice, and that choice was we had to go to trial.
Okay, how long did the trial last?
The trial lasted 89 days. The government called 53 witnesses and produced over 1,000 exhibits. And we didn't call any witnesses, and we didn't produce any exhibits, but we did cross-examine one of theirs. They had a fellow from the U.S. Treasury Department who was testifying as to the actual date that a date was put on a piece of paper, because that was going to turn the whole trial. This was a buy-sell agreement between me and my partner. And the government was making the allegation that that document was created after he did his dirty deed, and it was done for the form of a cover-up. And obviously my contention was that, no, that document was dated 2 years earlier, as it says on the face of the document. Well, the Treasury Department, they're the people that do our money, the ink and currency, and they know a lot about ink and paper and currency. And so they did the forensics. I knew what the answer was because it was put on there 2 years earlier. Well, this guy kept testifying that he thought it was put on there afterwards. And kept saying evasive words like, well, I think, and I would think, maybe, and, you know, it might look like, and he never said it definitely. And the more he kept saying it indefinitely, the more the red flags were popping up. So when it came our turn to cross-examine him, because this is on direct examination that he wasn't being very firm. When we did him on cross-examination, we literally, as I say, beat him around the shoulders like a Mexican pinata at a birthday party. And we did everything we could to shake the truth out of him. And on the third day, he finally admitted that 2 years prior to my indictment, he had issued a written report to the Justice Department. He's with the Treasury Department. And they sent him the documents. And he sent the written report back saying to them, in his opinion, the odds were 60 million to one that that date was put on there 2 years before the crime.
And that did it. That got you to win the trial.
Yeah, the jury heard that and rolled their eyes and acquitted me on all 57 counts.
That's great. Tell me about your attorney. He was on morphine while he was defending you?
Yeah. And like I said, I couldn't afford any civil lawyer to handle my civil stuff with my own money was locked up, which put Kathy and I into bankruptcy. But my finances were equally limited on a criminal side. And so the lawyer I wanted to hire was a fellow out of California. His name was Lane Phillips. He's the youngest U.S. attorney and youngest federal judge. Now back to privacy law. And he's really smart. And I thought, okay, if anybody can prove my innocence, it'll be him. Well, he wanted more money than I can afford, but he gave me a referral. And the referral he gave me was to a fellow former U.S. attorney named Pat Ryan. And Pat Ryan is a lovely man and a great, great lawyer and a good, good person. But Pat also suffered a lot of physical ailments, so many, and I don't even know all of them, that he had a prescription for morphine. So every day during trial, around 10 o'clock, he would have to go to the restroom during our break and shoot himself up with morphine. It was all prescribed, and it was medically authorized, and it did him good. And again, I love Pat Ryan. Without him, I wouldn't be talking to you on the phone today unless there are 3 inches of plexiglass somewhere between us. So don't ever hear me say anything negative, but you can't imagine the look on my face when I'd see him walk out of the bathroom and his eyes, it looked like silver dollars. And then he would have to go and do some cross-examination. And the rest of my 600 years are going to depend on how well he did it. Oh, man, that would be enough to scare the bejeebers out of you.
Now tell me, the situation, because you were subchapter S, because of the laws with that, was that the reason why you ended up with a $20 million judgment against you in the bankruptcy courts?
It is, exactly. We were a subchapter S corporation, which means the corporation really doesn't have taxes. The shareholders have taxes. But because it is just that, we had gone, in the early days, the very early days, gone to our lawyers and our accountants and our Wall Street bankers and all of the people who get too opine, because we didn't have any outside shareholders, and said, this is the way we want to do it. We want the company to pay these taxes, and they can debit us against our shareholder account, so it isn't like they're giving us something for nothing, but they will be the ones actually writing the check for the taxes that are then due, because the taxes are off of corporate earnings. And everybody agreed. Everybody signed up. Everybody said, that's wonderful. The IRS even said, that's copacetic. That's exactly the way it should be done. That's okay. But when we end up filing bankruptcy, in bankruptcy, the bankruptcy trustee gets some really strange powers, and one of them is they can undo a contract. So even though we had a contract between me, in this case, my wife, and our own corporation, that the taxes should be handled in this way, he could undo and did undo that contract, and once he undid it, there was no contract. And so then he could say, well, Mr. Bartman, who paid these taxes? And I would have to say, and I did, my corporation, and say, aha, have you repaid them? And say, no, I have not, and nor do I have an obligation to. What do you mean you don't have an obligation to? I said, well, I have a contract that says, no, you don't have a contract. There I am in this catch-22 where I have to admit that my company did pay my taxes, but I don't get to testify to the rest of the sentence.
Tell me about 877 Blow Whistle.
Kathy and I created a private foundation, a 501c3, a tax-exempt foundation, to help people do what could have saved our company. In other words, I want to create a whistleblowing organization, a whistleblowing foundation that allows people to report crime inside their own company. And the reason I do that is because it cost me $3.5 billion, because nobody in my company told me what my partner was up to. Now, I don't know how many of them knew, and I don't think any of them knew he was doing something illegal, but I think there were many people who testified at trial that they were concerned about what they saw him do, and they were nervous about what they saw him do, and they had some anxiety over what they saw him do. Now, every one of them testified they never told anybody. They never told anybody, but they came into a courtroom and said they had had these earlier feelings. Now, whether they really had those earlier feelings at that earlier moment, or whether those are things that people think of, no time of trial to satisfy some urge or another, I'm not really sure, and I'll never really know the difference. But assuming they're all telling the truth, assuming they're all credible, assuming they're all sincere, then those are the people, if any one of which had come to me and told me, that I might have stopped what he was doing before the train wreck. And if I could have stopped him before the train wreck, maybe 3,900 people still had their job.
How did the high school students react?
Michael, it is the most amazing thing. You know, everyone has told me that they are the hardest and the toughest and the most critical or cynical or skeptical audience of all, and I have found that to be 100% wrong.
Do they really have lots of questions for you?
Oh, they do. I mean, you walk in, you get their attention, and I cheat. I mean, I buy their attention, and I'm such a panderer, it's disgusting. I walk up after they've done this two-minute introduction, the DVD intro that you've seen on my website. So that gets their attention, at least preliminarily. Say, okay, this isn't chopped liver, but who cares? Because we're a kid, and he's a business guy, and we don't care too much about business. So I walk up to the stage or the middle of the auditorium wherever I happen to be delivering at, and I reach in my back pocket, and I pull out a wad of $100 bills. And I take one off the pile and put the rest back in my pocket, and I snap it a couple of times in front of me. And by now, I have everybody in the room's attention. I own them at this moment. And I'm talking, I'm already saying something, and I'm fiddling with this $100 bill. Well, I'm not talking about the $100 bill. I'm already into a piece of my presentation. And when I know they're all doing nothing but staring at the $100 bill, I go, oh, that, yeah, well, that's a $100 bill. Would one of you like this? Well, duh. You know, the whole crowd goes nuts because they all want one. They all start yelling and screaming and raising their hand and doing whatever it is they do in their culture. And I say, okay, well, I can't give everybody one, so I'm going to give this to one person. I'll give it to the person who gets the answer right to the question I'm going to ask during the course of my presentation. And with that, I lay the $100 bill in front of me on the floor and say, I'll put it right here so that we all remember that I have to do this before I'm done here today. Well, now they're all staring at the floor watching my $100 bill. And because they know, I've just told them, that there's going to be a question that I'm going to ask and that the answer to which could mean the difference between having a $100 bill or not having a $100 bill, they begin paying rapt attention to what it is I'm about to say for fear that they're going to miss the question.
That's great technique.
But it works. It works every time. And so I get going for about 20, 25 minutes, and that's just about the end of their attention span. And when I think I'm losing them or they're beginning to fidget or they get budditis or whatever it's called, I bend down and pick up the $100 bill. And now I have them again. Now they're all back, you know, like all the lions back on their chairs, they're all back where they belong. And I say, okay, well, let's talk about this $100 bill. Here's the question. And I pose the question. If you were to stack $100 bills one on top of the other, and I show them sideways what a dollar bill looks like, it's pretty thin, pretty skinny, then how tall would the stack be to get $1 billion worth of $100 bills? And then we have traveling microphones that literally are throughout the crowd, and kids get to stand up and say, well, 3 foot, 6 foot, 20 foot, whatever it is they're going to say, and they can come up with almost any number they choose to. But almost always they are talking in the 10 foot, 20 foot, 50 foot range. Sometimes they'll really jump way out there and say, no, 100 feet. And the real answer is 8,400.
8,400 feet tall?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it just kind of blows their comprehension. But somebody always wins because I tell them whoever gets the closest to the right answer will win. Well, whoever has come up with the largest number obviously is it. And with that, we make a production out of going over to that person, giving them the $100 bill, or having them come up on stage to get the $100 bill, and we get to talk for a minute, that person and myself. And then there's usually a loud round of applause for the individual who has won the $100 bill. And then if the person takes their seat again, I said, now, how many people like that person? And everybody cheers and raises their hand and wants to be their friend. They said, how many people would have wanted to have been that friend before the $100 bill? And only a few hands go up. I said, now, isn't that interesting? That because this person has an extra $100 bill in their pocket, we all like him more than we liked him a little bit ago. Isn't that interesting? And depending on the crowd and the audience, I'll make a point out of it as well. But the real purpose of a $100 bill is to buy their attention.
Wow, what a fascinating story. What is Bill Bartman's mission today?
I am on a number of missions, and they're all compatible. I carry a card in my pocket. It's called my Pocket Promise, and it says I will touch the lives of 10 million people in the next 5 years. That's my major, major objective in life. And when I say touch the lives of, I now give speeches all over the country. I put on seminars all over the country. I've written books and some workbooks and stuff like that. This is all I do now, Michael. It is just try to inspire people, and I don't mean motivation. I'm not out there doing jumping jacks on stage, and I'm not juggling chainsaws, and I'm not trying to get people to come up on stage and break boards or, you know, run through flaming coals. I don't do that stuff, and I'm not knocking that stuff. That's just not my shtick. I want to talk to people about how they can feel better about themselves and how they can face some challenges in life. And then I coach them. Once I get them up as an individual, then I coach them in business. I have this dubious distinction. I'm the only billionaire business coach in the whole world. I'm the only guy coaching businesses who's ever really made $1 billion. I understand it. I'm not an expert. I don't think I'm all that smart. But I am really, really experienced. And I share that experience and guidance or tutelage with my students.
Bill, it's been a pleasure. I've overstepped my time. You have a great day. Thank you so much. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye. For more free reports, products, and services from Bill Bartman, go to www.billionairebubba.com. That's www.billionairebubba.com. BillionaireBubba.com. For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.